Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how chemicals, very common in most people's home, could be adversely affecting the social behavior of your children, a study from Oregon State University, and how research can provide solutions for the future treatment of diabetes. I'll tell you what those treatments are. Research done at the University of Alberta. Also, a study shows that inhaling a common, very common manufacturing material, carbon nanotubules, could inadvertently injure your brain, Virginia Commonwealth University. And exciting findings, capsicum, that extract from red pepper, well, it can help you slim down your waist, Baylor University and Auburn University. And also, new research set to improve traditional Chinese cancer treatments, University of Queensland. A lot more on health and healing. And then today is commentary day. For example, enemies of the state, how the financial services industry is destroying democracy. And this is from the European Financial Review from Graham Van Bergen. Also today, the deep state versus President Trump from Gary Olson from Common Dreams. I'm going to talk today also about how 90% of American households lost $17,000 in wealth to the plutocrats last year. Unless you're very wealthy, unless you're one of the 1%, you lost $17,000 in value. I'll explain how that happens. And the unseen people who no longer own a home, who were homeless, now are renting. 1 in 4 U.S. renters are using over 50% of their income each month just to pay for their housing costs. That's a huge amount. Ideally, in a really balanced society, it should be about 15%. Whether you own, paying for mortgage or maintenance, insurances and taxes, or whether you rent, you shouldn't pay more than 15%, but 50%? Well, exactly what does that leave for food and clothing and education and car payments and student loans? It leaves nothing. We'll talk about that. How bad is it? Well, you'd never know it's bad at all if you just listen to the talking heads saying, hey, since the presidency of Trump, we've gone up 3,000 points on Wall Street. That's all artificial. It's a bubble. But according to Reuters, how bad is the car loan repayment business? 8-year peak. That's right. More Americans fell behind on their car loan payments for the fourth quarter, bringing auto delinquencies to their highest since the height of the financial crisis. And that's from the Federal Reserve Bank and of New York. So if people are behind on their credit card payments, they are. On their student loans, they are. And on their car payments, they are. And on their mortgage payments, they are. Well, what does that tell you for about 75% of all Americans? And yet, what is being done to help them? How about nothing? And I'm going to go to our guest early in the program today because she has something really important to share with us. She is Professor Susanna Heschel, and she is the Eli Black Professor of Jewish Studies and a member of the Women and Gender Studies faculty at Dartmouth College. And she's the daughter of the renowned Jewish civil rights activist and spiritual leader, Rabbi Abraham Heschel. And we're going to talk about historical lessons to learn from Christian fascism and Nazi propaganda during the Third Reich and the staging of Trump to the public. Is there a correlation? You'll be able to determine that for yourself after you hear our discussion. After all, there's a lot on Islam that's being talked about, but nothing about Christianity. And next week, I'll be doing a 1-hour special on how violent are all of the major religions. And so we will have religious scholars on discussing the fact that all religions, if you chose, you could be extremely violent based upon what's in their actual texts and their literal interpretations. But you could also find peace and harmony and cooperation. So it's all a matter of interpretation, and you'll hear the scholars discussing this. So that's our program. We have a lot to share. I don't know if we'll get to audio clips, but we have a lot of them if we do. Let's now take a look at some of the latest things in health and healing. And by the way, the reason I give the citations for all the work I do is because we're known as a program of record when it comes to health and environmental issues, meaning there's a great deal of scholarship that goes into it. And we want you to have some confidence that if we're telling you there's something good, well, it's because it's been documented. For example, from Oregon State University, published in the Environmental Health Journal, there's some chemicals added to your furniture, electronics, your computers, televisions, and other goods to prevent fires. And this is called flame retardant chemicals. Well, what we didn't know is that they had unintended consequences, especially for children. Researchers from Oregon State University found a significant relationship between social behaviors among children and their exposure to widely used flame retardants. And quote, when we analyzed behavioral assessment and exposure levels, we observed that the children who had more exposure to certain types of flame retardants were more likely to exhibit externalizing behaviors such as aggression, defiance, hyperactivity, inattention, and bullying. Quote, this is an intriguing finding because no one had previously studied the behavioral effects of the organophosphate and the flame retardants, which have been added to consumer products more recently. Just so you understand, the flame retardants are found throughout the built environment in furniture, mattresses, carpeting of your vehicle, and the chemicals are added to the product and are not bound to the material, which cause them to be released indoors. So when you walk across a carpet that has had formaldehyde added as a preservative and or flame retardants, millions of tiny little particulate matter go into the air. You can't see it, but it does. And every time you clean a floor, you're releasing some of these. So there's growing concerns that some flame retardants have unintended impact upon the development of the brain. Now, I remember back in the 1970s, there was a Dr. Feingold out in California, and he came up with a unique concept that the chemicals used in our foods, such as the emulsifiers and the additives and the thickening agents and the preservatives, the coloring agents and the taste enhancers, all could impact a child's brain in such a way that the child would act out. He was being attacked by almost every one of the food manufacturers saying this is all nonsense, there's no truth to it. And I went out to California and I met with him and I said, I'm going to do a study. In fact, it was a really good study on hyperactive children. And one of the people who brought three children to the study was a regular Orthodox board certified physician out of New York City. And the woman said, I know there's something here, I just don't know what it is. And I can't find anything in the scientific literature to justify anything because my husband, who's also a physician, says it's all nonsense. So I want to see if it's true. And so for 3 months, every day, the families involved had to have no processed sugars, nothing that had anything artificial in it, no preservative, coloring agents. In effect, they went on a very healthy plant-based diet, lots of juices. And to help them, I showed them, for example, how to take tofu, add cumin as a seasoning and turmeric and some black pepper and sea salt. And then you take it was very simple. You simply take a block of the tofu in your hands and you make a fist. And the tofu breaks up and comes through your fingers. And then when you use hickory seasoning, natural hickory seasoning, it tastes exactly like scrambled eggs that was made with bacon. And so the kids never knew during the whole study that they weren't eating bacon and eggs. They had no bacon and eggs. The what tastes like bacon was a seasoned tempeh in strips. In any case, they had lots of juices, no dairy, no sugar. Now, here's what happened at the end. The woman physician came over to me and said, "There is no question now that what we are feeding our kids and the beverages and the foods are directly impacting their brain." And this was the first such study on this, where everything was excluded and only organic. Feingold had done a previous study, but it was mainly excluding certain foods, but it wasn't based upon a plant-based diet. In any case, she says, "Before the study, my kids would come home from school and literally be bouncing off the walls because of all the things they ate at school and after school. Now, they're just normal kids. They have energies that they dissipate in sports and being outside. But the evenness of their thoughts is just remarkable." And I said, "What did your husband think?" She said, "No matter what proof I have, he is so close-minded, he won't believe it." I said, "Fine. You believe it. Your kids are evidence of it." Well, across the board, we had a 93% improvement rate where kids who've been diagnosed with ADD and ADHD, or at that time it was really not called ADD and ADHD, it was called hyperactivity, were completely normal. Now, I just want to share that with you because one of the things that we also did in a later study with adults who had chemical sensitivities, and I had worked with Dr. Theron Randolph in Chicago, the father of environmental health, and Dr. Marshall Mandel in Connecticut, who found ways of testing people to see if there was even the tiniest amount of chemical reaction in a food that could cause brain allergies, which could manifest as aggression. And so I set up another study in which it was more than diet. Diet, yes, but you had to get rid of all anything in the house that was made by particle board or had chemical outgassing. So you stripped down to the floors and then put a sealant on it, and which was a resin with beeswax, and so it wouldn't, no outgassing, and using no aluminum cooking, using stainless steel, real stainless steel, and or glass crockery, and drinking no fluoridated water. They had to filter their water. And again, remarkable improvement in the people who had environmental sensitivities. So this is just the latest study showing you you are directly connected, as are your children, to what they're inhaling. And now there's proof of it. I work with diabetics all the time. It's amazing how quickly a diabetic can go from being just overweight and diabetic to serious infection, collapse of their immune system. I had it happen just a week ago, tomorrow, where I got a call from someone I know who said he was in good health. I said, "Well, that's not possible." "Why not?" "Well, because you're morbidly obese. Even if you were slightly overweight, that would be a strike against you, but you're morbidly obese. Your blood resting blood sugar is 225. That's a big problem for all the cells in your body. And you also have high blood pressure, and you're stressed, and your immune system is collapsed." So when the person was told they were going to have their legs or their feet amputated, that got their attention. And I thought to myself, why is it everyone I know personally, I'm only referring to people I know personally, friends and family, the only time you ever get their attention is when there's a massive crisis that they can no longer do their little shuffle and whistle in the wind out the door in denialism. So, undivided attention. Now, thank goodness a person put them on a protocol, which initially the hospital wouldn't accept, but then did. And when enough scientific proof of each of the different elements was provided. Blood sugar is normal. Blood pressure is normal. The immune system is improving. The circulation is back in the toes. The special surgery is now not going to happen, so the person saved their foot. And it's more than that. It saved his life. And that's because when you're diabetic, you're going to die sooner, a lot sooner. And it's unfortunate that we're not honest with people about how severe the consequences of diabetes or prediabetes are. Well, there is good news out of the University of Alberta, and that is that the research is showing one new treatment would be resveratrol. Write it down if you're not familiar with it. Res, R-E-S, Vera, V-E-R-A, Trol, T-R-O-L, resveratrol. And it's a powerful antioxidant, and it's produced in some plants, mainly to protect the plant against the stresses that the environment is growing in. Now, a professor, Jason Dyke, at the University of Alberta, was looking at all the different ways that you can reduce blood sugar and have a healthier heart, and he found that one of the most important things could be done is resveratrol. And it's shown to effectively lower blood sugar levels, and the amount of resveratrol found circulating in the blood is very low. And so you need to get it up. And by the way, this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes. And so you get your resveratrol up. And in this study, it was only a 6-week study. And it made a big difference, giving healthier bacteria to the intestine, improving glucose tolerance. And so I would suggest between 150 to 300 milligrams a day of resveratrol. Another study from the Virginia Commonwealth University found that inhaling a common manufacturing material called carbon nanotubules, you could injure your brain. And once again, these are very easy to inhale out there. For example, we find it in a lot of manufacturing. And you can test in your hair sample to see if you have them. So our environment is important. If you're working in a toxic environment, if you're buying things that are made cheaply using petrochemicals, just be aware that there's an environmental health hazard to it, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier. These neuroinflammatory effects of inhaled carbon nanotubules show close links between respiratory and vascular systems and the brain. So stay with what is natural and non-toxic. And finally, from Baylor University and Auburn University, they did a study published in the journal Appetite. The 2-milligram dose of the capsaicinoids for 12 weeks significantly reduced the impact of fat on the body. And that's good. So it's good for a lot of reasons. I suggest it to help prevent a heart attack and stroke, thin the blood, oxygenate the tissue, turn off pain, lower blood pressure, lower blood sugar. It does all that. But just one more thing, it helps with weight reduction. And that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We have some commentaries to share with you, and we have an interesting guest coming up to talk about historical lessons to learn from Christian fascism and Nazi propaganda by a really brilliant and insightful professor who has spent 20 years writing on the subject. So you're getting the best of the best on this particular topic. I just want to quickly mention that coming up in about 3 weeks from now, we're going to have our one and only retreat of the year. It will be the first and or second week of April, It'll be in a beautiful setting down in the mountains near Texarkana in Louisiana. It is a chance to change your life. And I have so many important new projects, including, I'll talk about it on an upcoming program, the Syrian Refugee Project, where I'm helping to put together some greenhouses and provide all the pregnant women with and the children and babies with special supplements, all free to them, of course, to save their lives, and also to allow them to be self-sufficient so they're not eating this really unpalatable and unhealthy food that they get when they get it. So that's taking an enormous amount of time, but also I have a couple more very important projects I'm doing, so that's the only time I'm going to have. It's not a vacation. It's not like going up to the Catskills and doing some meditation or yoga, which are wonderful and I recommend. This is for those people who really need to de-stress, detoxify, and to rejuvenate. The latest insights and information, things I do not have the time to go into on a radio program, I'm not limited there, so I lecture every night, sometimes 3 hours. There's counseling on any issue that you find important in your life. There's the best food you're going to taste anywhere in America. This is the gourmet vegan diet. All original recipes, juicing all day long, all that you want to put in your body, all alkalizing, exercising, water aerobics in non-fluoridated water that's the deep, deep, comes up from 800 feet, the mineral water that you're drinking and you're using in the swimming pool. There's exercise. There's all kinds of workshops, yoga, meditation, and artist healing. And you can do as little or as much as you want. So there's 2 places left in the first week and 1 place left in the second, and that's it. We're full. And we have a wonderful staff of people that I work with who come together wherever they live, from Santa Fe, from Taos, New Mexico, from Colorado, from Boulder, from all across America they come. And these are some of the finest, most positive, creative, and happy people you're ever going to meet. These are the staff. And I limit the number of guests so that everyone can get personal attention. This is a quiet environment. We ask people to remain in silence most of the time. We certainly eat in silence. Most of the other activities are in silence. People can talk in the workshop where they're asking questions. But otherwise, it's a time to turn off the cell phones and give yourself a reprieve. The trouble is most people don't believe that they deserve it, and hence they don't make their own needs a priority. Everyone else, yes, not themselves. Well, there are passages in life. There are times when things change, just like on WBAI. 41 years, 5 days a week, now 1 day a week. And that may be ending tomorrow. So things change. And I've gone from doing over 200 of these retreats to what will be no more retreats because I've got so many other important projects that I'm working on. I'm going to play now just 2 little testimonials from people who were at the last retreat. Here's their experience.
Hi, this is Damien, and I've just completed a week's retreat with Gary. The main reason I came here was to go through a change, and that's what I've done. I accomplished what I came out here to do. The effect out here is very positive, and it made the change that much easier to transition. And it was just so great. If you're not a vegan and you had any meal here.
Also, we will be having workshops on what to do when disaster strikes, the best places to live, the eco communities, the cooperative communities, and a whole new concept that I've come up with that I'm actually going to implement this year called quality of life communities. And that'll take about 6 hours over 2 days. But I'm going to do it there. And also gardening, homesteading, microgreen growing. You actually see how microgreens are grown because you're eating them and they're being grown. And sprouts and hydroponics. If you're in a blue mood or questioning life at this point or your next step in your life, if you're depressed, anxious, this is the place to be because there's a lot of help going to come your way. If you want to come, we've got room for two people on the first week of April and one person the second week. That's it. Then call Lou Ann and see if it's right for you. The number is 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Before we go to our guests, I want to share some insights that should give us a little bit to think about. We keep hearing about the deep state. Well, the deep state is real. Isn't it interesting when we were talking over 5 years ago about how you should be careful because everything you say in your car is being recorded? You're actually where you're going on your journey, it's all recorded. That your telephone is recording you at home even when you turn it off. Your television is recording and all audio video. People thought that was crazy. Well, the CIA just showed through the release of its documents through WikiLeaks, no, they're doing it on everything. What gives them the right to do that? I don't give them the right, nor should you. And according to Gary Olson, you don't want to be listening to the corporate media. I agree with that, like CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, Washington Post, and elements within the Intelligence Committee are singing from the same hymnal. Why? They're denouncing and demonizing President Trump. Okay, fine. He does something wrong. He screws up. He hires the wrong people, which he has. Criticize him for it. That's completely legitimate. But just remember, these people are not saving democracy because they're the ones who gave us the man who took away our democracy with the National Defense Authorization Act and also the woman who caused millions of people in the Middle East to lose their lives and homes. And she would have been in the White House. Now, for them, that would have been perfect. For the rest of us who live in the real world, that would not be. Now, you'll hear me say in a few moments that I believe that Donald Trump is a neo-fascist demagogue, and his actions should be resisted at every step. However, this is not what's motivating most of his critics, and that's where the public is being played for fools. To understand why that's the case, I highly recommend Micah Loughran, who you've heard on this program, the book called The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution, The Rise of the Shadow Government. Loughran, L-O-F-G-R-E-N, began his Capitol Hill career as a traditional Republican, serving 30 years as a high-level staff analyst for the House and Senate Budget Committees. And he wrote the book after becoming totally disillusioned. And his analysis and revelations are those of a consummate insider. And were I teaching an introductory course in American politics, that book would be a primary text. So what is the deep state, for those of you who are still a little confused? It's a hybrid network of structures within our government which has the actual power. It's none of the ones you see publicly. It's what is controlling those that you see publicly. It includes the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, hordes of private contractors, probably over 400,000 of them in Washington alone, whose sole client is the government. It is the National Security Agency. It is the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA, Homeland Security. Those are just a few of the members of the Congressional Defense and Intelligence Committee, and so on. And except for a handful of congresspersons, the deep state members have not been elected and are accountable to no one. They profoundly influence virtually every domestic and foreign matter of consequence. D.J. Hopkins, another close student of this phenomenon, notes that, quote, the system served by the deep state is not the United States of America, the country most Americans believe they live in. The system it serves is globalized capitalism. Well, and they do so regardless of which party is nominally in control. Loughran takes pains to point out that the deep state is not a coven of diabolical conspirators. It has evolved over several decades to become the antithesis of democracy. Why does the deep state fear and despise Trump then? First, his chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, is a fervent disciple of capitalist economic nationalism. And further, his America is the shining city on the hill metaphor, but where the dwellers are Christian white people. Deep state types are convinced Trump's skewed priorities will undermine the dominant role played by the United States in global capitalist system, from which they derive their power and wealth and the ultra-lavish lifestyles. So we're witnessing a no-holds-barred clash between two warring ideologies. And second, both the Pentagon and their arms dealer friends are salivating over a new Cold War with Russia and China. And they will do anything to sabotage enhancing peaceful understanding between Washington and Moscow, or Washington and Iran, or Washington and China. This explains their hysterical Kremlin baiting of Trump. And unlike Trump, he sent chills through the deep state when he voiced doubts about NATO. Now, NATO is a completely evil organization. It should not exist. And yet, it's through NATO that they do their dirty bidding. And lastly, Trump's erratic behavior and his penchant for confrontation and unwillingness to be a team player render him an unreliable caretaker of the deep state interest. They much preferred Hillary Clinton or even Jeb Bush. Trump was the Frankenstein populist, as Paul Street's term, who shockingly won the election. Now he threatens to unwittingly expose their theater of the absurd, their contrived democracy. And Trump's dramatic increase in defense spending may temporarily assuage the military contractors within the deep state, because they're all feeding off of it. They don't need it. It's just pure profit. On the other hand, this and other Trump policies will, ironically, severely exacerbate economic problems for many working class folk who voted for him last November. Their bitter awakening might well cause alienation and social disruption that no one in the upper circles of power wants to contemplate. So that's the deep state. These are real people and running real organizations and have real power. And everything was fine. It was fine through Gerald Ford. It was fine through Nixon. It was fine through Senior Bush, through Reagan, through not so fine through Carter, but absolutely great during Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And it would have been spectacular if Hillary Clinton had been elected. That's why the excessive reaction. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stand by. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. My guest right now on the line from the Boston area is Professor Susanna Heschel. I mentioned earlier her background, gave you her bio, and that we were going to talk today about the historical lessons to learn from Christian fascism and Nazi propaganda during the Third Reich and the staging of Trump to the public. And by the way, her father, the civil rights activist and the spiritual leader, Rabbi Abraham Heschel, who is well known for his marching alongside Martin Luther King during the Selma, Alabama protest. The King family regarded him as one of the great men of all time. And Susanna edited a collection of her father's essential teachings for the Modern Spiritual Master series in her very important new work, The Aryan Jesus, Christian Theologians and the Bible in Nazi Germany, is the result of 20 years' research into the history of anti-Semitic doctrine within the German Christian movement and the Catholic Church in Nazi Germany, and details how Christianity was perverted to foment a racist doctrine serving the political ambitions of the Nazi regime. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
There are many who genuinely believe that Trump represents a very real threat of fascism rising in Washington, D.C. It's not conjecture that Trump lied his way into the White House, and now we are witnessing a dismantling of years, even decades, of civil rights progress, including the efforts of your father. And his major supporters include the alt-right white supremacy movement, best represented by his special advisor, Steve Bannon, and his Breitbart News Network. He won over 80% of the far-right Christian evangelical vote. And as you indicated, these also include many Orthodox Jewish individuals as well. And throughout Trump's campaign, we observed instances of vigilante hate and racism and violence among his followers. So from my personal perspective, if history has anything to teach us, we have not witnessed this in a long time, and we would have to go back to Nazi Germany in the early 1930s to see the rise of Hitler and the Nazi Party. Is it an accident that today many educated historians and journalists are noting parallels between the Trump rise to the White House and the backgrounds of his cabinet members with what unfolded in Nazi Germany? For example, Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, written in the early 1950s, has seen booming sales on Amazon, as has Orwell's 1984. So please share some of your research into the Christian movement during Hitler's rise to power and the parallels that you find worth noting with Trump's allegiance with a very large segment of the American extreme religious conservatism. And second, are there associations that might be made between anti-Semitism that was bred within German Christianity during the Reich and the Islamophobia we are observing today, especially among many of Trump's cabinet members? The forum is yours.
Thank you. First of all, I think it's not an accident that we're constantly drawing analogies to the Nazi period. Part of it is because Trump's campaign was deliberately modeling much of it on the basis of what Hitler did to come to power. So let me give you an example. Some people may have seen the very famous propaganda film made by Leni Riefenstahl about the Nuremberg rally. In fact, she staged the rally in order to make the film. And the film opens with pictures of the clouds. You see the sky, and you see the clouds in the sky. And then after some minutes, finally, you see a little object emerging as the clouds part, and it's Hitler's plane. And the plane comes down over the medieval city of Nuremberg. And finally, it lands, and Hitler gets out, and everybody's cheering and so forth. Same thing with Trump. He used to land his great big plane emblazoned with Trump on the side, and people were cheering and so on. That's no accident. I would say it's not just an analogy. It's a deliberate act of citation of what the constitution of Trump, who he was as a person, who he came to represent in people's minds, the Trump myth. This was deliberately drawn, I'm sure, from Triumph of the Will. And of course, his advisors knew that film. Now, when it comes to the question of church and Jewish support for Trump, I would say I'm beginning to wonder if we really can speak about Judaism and Christianity as two separate entities in the United States. It seems to be much more useful to distinguish instead between right-wing religious people and left-wing religious people. Because the teachings that I hear from Jews and from Christians on the right and Jews and Christians on the left are remarkably similar. That is, the right-wing people think a certain way. And yes, right-wing Orthodox Jews voted for Trump in large number. Not only religious, of course, there are right-wing Jews who are secular, fine. And ultra-Orthodox, for example, Borough Park neighborhood in Brooklyn went for Trump. So we can ask about that. But you asked me also to say something about the Christian churches and Hitler's rise to power. Let me point out that it was the Roman Catholic Church, the Vatican, that was the first diplomatic entity to formally recognize Hitler after he came to power in 1933. In July 1933, the Vatican signed a concordat, an agreement with Hitler, the first government to do so. That's very remarkable. In fact, the Catholic Church in Germany was suspicious of Hitler for many reasons. They had their own political party, the Catholic Center Party. They didn't need the Nazi Party. And much of what the Nazi Party offered, such as groups for teenagers and youth groups, and, for instance, clothes for your children. You could go to a special place, the Nazi Party would give you clothes, overcoats for the winter, and so forth. The Catholic Church already had its own social service network, but the Protestants were very attracted to the Nazi Party. They needed that social service, and they liked the sense of community. And in fact, they were enthusiastic supporters of Hitler even before he came to power. They supported him. And as soon as he came to power in January 33, they just started drooling over him. Theologians, people with doctorates, people who were serious scholars were writing with adulation about Hitler and wanted to have the church model itself after the Nazi Reich. Now, Hitler, of course, in the beginning, before he came to power, was a little concerned about the churches, because if anybody could muster opposition to the Nazis in the late 20s and early 30s, it would be the churches. But what he found, and it was so remarkable, what Hitler found was that the churches were already in his pocket. He didn't have to worry about them. By the end of 1934, he didn't have to coddle the churches anymore. They were for him. If anything, the churches were disappointed, because after 1934, Hitler wasn't that interested in bringing, let's say, a bishop to march at the head of a Nazi parade. And the bishops complained about it. So, for instance, there was a man named Martin Zasa who was consecrated as the Bishop of Thuringia in 1934. And at the consecration in a church, people said the church was full of brown shirts. Those are the members of the SA. It's kind of a voluntary organization. But when Martin Zasa, the bishop, died in 1942, the church had no brown shirts in it. Because Hitler wasn't interested anymore. He didn't need the church. He had them already. He didn't have to do anything. Now, what's the situation here? We found a lot of evangelical leaders, and I think now of Jerry Falwell Jr., for example, falling all over themselves for Trump. And plenty of Jewish leaders, too, to this day, right-wing Jewish leaders. And frankly, I wonder about this. What do they think they're going to get for this, actually? Is he going to throw them some crumbs? What does Trump need these people for? What for? Hitler didn't need the churches. When are church people and Jewish people going to realize that this is not the way to go? That the role of a religious leader is to stand outside the government in a prophetic tradition, to be independent, to criticize when needs be, to make demands, but not to be in bed with the government. That is absolutely not the place for a religious leader. Now, you ask about Islamophobia. What's happened now is a very insidious, sinister conspiracy, one might say, that began in a very neutral way. That is, already in the 1930s and 40s, we had in the United States an effort to bring a priest, a minister, and a rabbi to give talks all over the country to show people that we in America believe in religious tolerance. And that was, in fact, an important effort. During the 1930s was a way of demonstrating that the United States is not fascist, like Germany, that's intolerant of religion, or not communist, like the Soviet Union. So Jews and Christians came together, and you started hearing the word Judeo-Christian. By the way, Kevin Schultz wrote an interesting book called Tri-Faith America about this movement. So they came together, Judeo-Christian, whatever that means. It's an awful term. It's completely inappropriate. And Jewish thinkers have protested against it. But it means basically that Jews and Christians can now say we are in alignment, and the people who are on the outside are the Muslims. They're not part of our group. You find this happening in Europe. In the past, in the 19th century, for example, Jews were not accepted as Germans or as French members of the French nation. There was some skepticism. Jews weren't really German, were they? You know, that kind of questioning. So Jews weren't part of the nation. Today, we find Europeans speaking about themselves as a European civilization. So the issue isn't whether you're part of the nation. The issue is whether you're part of the civilization. Jews are part of this Judeo-Christian unity and accepted in Europe. Muslims are said to be outside the framework of European civilization. And that's the kind of Islamophobia one finds in Europe. Mahdi Bunzel, the anthropologist, has written about this. So what can we do? First of all, we need to also recognize the Jews, Muslims, and Christians who are standing in opposition to Trump and who are doing very good work. In one way, this is not analogous to Nazi Germany. There, you would not find churches and synagogues offering refuge, places of refuge for undocumented so-called aliens. The word is an impossible word and shouldn't be used. People who are on the verge of being deported. And I want to also say we have to be attentive to the language we're using in this country right now. Because just as Nazi Germany changed the German language, we are changing the English language. I am the child of a refugee from Nazi Germany. I'm named for my grandmother who was murdered by the Nazis. And I never thought in my life that I would hear Americans talking about deportations. I don't want to hear that word. So there are efforts to act in opposition as well as to speak in opposition. And a lot of it is coming from the left, from religious people on the left. They are Jewish, they are Christian, they are Muslim, they are Sikhs, they are Buddhists. And we need to recognize and applaud what they're doing and publicize it.
I have a follow-up question for you. You've noted something I found fascinating, that is the way Trump's public relations machine has deliberately staged him to the public. You referred to it earlier about Trump's big airplane coming in, and it was always
yes.
His movements, his biggest rallies were at an airport. That's rarely happened in the past. And you also mentioned the Triumph of the Will, directed by Leni Riefenstahl, that film essentially portrayed Germany's return to being a great power, which
yes.
is not different from Trump's Making America
exactly.
Great Again slogan. So tell us a bit about this propaganda film and more than what you just did about the Hitler coming in and seeing that little dot in the sky and then everyone applauding him, because in my opinion, and again, I'm not projecting out to anyone else believing this, but I see Steve Bannon, who could be compared at one level to Trump's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. In fact, Andrew Breitbart has called Bannon the Leni Riefenstahl of the Tea Party. So provide us your analysis of this association and what is the Trump image message that his administration is trying to convey to Americans?
Well, the image extends beyond the opening scenes of Triumph of the Will, because the film about the Nazi rally also shows young men, for example, with blonde hair and blue eyes. I mean, it's a black and white film, but you can tell washing up at the end of the beginning of the day in the morning, getting out of their tents and getting ready for the day and putting on their uniforms and marching around. And they're all very, what we would call today, clean cut. A very Aryan, very white, very shiny. And you look at it and you think, oh, they look so wholesome. And I think Trump and his rallies is also trying to gather people who will look to America as wholesome people. Now, the truth is also that if you look at the people who attended his rallies, 99% are white Americans, of course. And then there are a few people who go to observe, but the way in which Trump's advisors model him and his movement after Hitler, I think, is picked up even in these small things, so that the audience watching on television or even present in the room will see something that they will find wholesome and appealing. Because we still in the United States very much have a pervasive notion that to be a wholesome person is to be a white person. So there's a racism to it. There's a way in which, of course, Trump is the id of America. He says all the bad words that we're not supposed to speak. He's the bad boy. people were just saying a few days ago in regard to the horrible so-called tweets, these messages that Trump sent out last weekend. Oh, you know Trump, or let Trump be Trump so he can be the naughty boy, the bad boy. Is that like Hitler? Yes, of course. Let's remember that Hitler also staged an attempted coup d'etat for which he was actually imprisoned, and of course in prison when he wrote Mein Kampf. But normally we don't take someone who's committed treason, staging a coup d'etat, and elect the person. You don't vote for such a person, but of course they did in Nazi Germany. And Trump, as we know, has broken the law in so many ways, by not renting to African Americans, by not paying the bills, by being involved in lawsuits that are not simply one company suing another, but people who did work for him and he didn't pay them. That's, to my mind, the utter dishonesty is a criminal offense. And what, a person like that should become the president? So why are we overlooking these things? And that's part of it also. How did Germans overlook all the horrible things about Hitler and go along with it? And on June 30th, 1934, when Hitler murdered some of his closest allies, some former members of the government. And nobody said anything in Germany. We're not saying anything either. This guy is a crook. And we accept him?
Do you feel Chris Hedges is correct when he labels the extreme evangelical right that supports Trump with Christian fascism? Because Hedges would argue it strives to institutionalize blatant nationalism and moral purity and the sanctification of law and order and the demonization of the other, and most notably Muslims, and is essentially cultish in nature. Would you find that accurate or not?
Yes. I would say, first of all, Chris Hedges is one of the most brilliant people I know. I've met him once, but he's an extraordinary person. And I think his analyses are always right on target. And here he's correct. I agree with him entirely. I also think we have in the United States a sensibility about ourselves and our country as if we are a Christian country and we are motivated by good Christian impulses. And I think that the Trump campaign, and I consider, by the way, this even in the White House, it's still a campaign, that they're playing on that. They're playing us. You know, we've all essentially been conned. I'm sure there are some people who voted for Trump and didn't quite understand what the whole thing was about, but they heard someone promise them jobs, et cetera, and they voted for him. They were conned. And we have here a psychological question. What do you do when somebody has been playing the slot machines at a casino and they're losing? When do they walk away? And let's say they're winning, but they could lose any minute. When do they walk away? And that's my question about Trump. At what point will we recognize we've been conned? When are we going to walk away from him?
I believe that the failure will come when he does not provide the jobs nor the quality of life to 63 million people. And those will be the ones who unseat him. He can take the slings and arrow of the opposition, thin-skinned as he is. He will tolerate it and fight back. He has no recourse when his own followers turn on him, and that's what I don't believe he has understood. Now, a professor of history at Kent State, Richard Stockmann Gall, noted that the Nazis were deeply concerned about Hitler's and the party's public image and opinion. In fact, it was the goal of the Nazis to gather consensus among the German people. And this is something we observe with Trump. Consistently in his speeches, he grossly exaggerates his popularity and support. He habitually and neurotically tweets constantly when there are voices of dissent in order to marginalize the opposition in such a way to make them appear as if criticisms are the exception rather than the norm among Americans. In other words, the Trump PR strategy is trying to delegitimize voices of dissent. So my question then is the deep emotional need to derive consensus and win public opinion, becomes in a critical weakness. And it is perhaps the case that Trump, as a flaming egotist, is far more fragile than we might assume. And finally, is this not a weakness that the nation's growing opposition might exploit to its advantage?
Well, questions. And by the way, yes, I agree with Richard Steigmann-Gall, but I would say that, first of all, I'm not as optimistic as you are that people, in the United States are going to recognize that Trump is not going to create jobs for them and that will turn against him, because we've had Republicans in power over and over again, and they've done the same thing. They've wrecked the economy, and yet we vote them back into office. I don't see a groundswell even now, people recognizing that it was George W. Bush who wrecked the economy in 2008 and Obama who fixed it. Why is it people aren't giving Obama the credit, by the way, for straightening out the economy? Even the jobs report that came out today and this very low unemployment rate, et cetera, that's not because of Trump. He didn't do that. It's still left over from Obama's policies. So why are people still voting for the Republicans when they're about to rob us of health insurance? People vote against their best interests. You remember that book by Tom Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas? What's the matter with the United States? Why do we vote for people whose interests are, as you yourself said earlier in the broadcast, whose interests are simply making big corporations richer? They're not out to help us. We vote for them. And I think the same thing is going on with Trump. Why is he president? He's not interested. He knows nothing. He's doing it for money. How much more money does he want? I don't know. As for the other people around him, same thing. Money, power. Are they doing something good? Look at the people he's appointed. Absolute incompetence. And if he does have people who are competent, will he even listen to them? Keep in mind, Hitler was interested in popularity only up to a point. People who were potential opponents, of course, he put into concentration camps. Trump is not at that point yet, but there are other tools we have in the United States to silence people, to silence opposition, and that does worry me. And look how we're being divided. First, go after the Muslims, go after the Mexicans, as he has done in his campaign rhetoric. Who's next? If we don't stick to our alliances, then what? And right now, yes, we do have opposition growing. I worry that that opposition is coming from people who do have jobs right now. Will that opposition be undermined when the economy tanks, as I'm sure it will with Trump? Will we then turn into little sheep and accept everything? I don't know. I am worried about that.
And rightly so. I appreciate your insights. We're out of time, and thank you very much for the good work you've done and the outstanding work on the Aryan Jesus, Christian theologians, and the Bible in Nazi Germany. 20 years of detailed research went into that, the history of anti-Semitic doctrine within the German Christian movement and the Catholic movement as well. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
From Boston, Professor Susanna Heschel, Heschel, whose father was the great leader, Rabbi Abraham Heschel. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.